It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, the Catholic Archdiocese of Milwaukee released its bankruptcy reorganization plan today. We'll find out what it means for the Archdiocese and for the people who filed lawsuits against it.
But first, looking back on American history, it can be easy to point out all the momentous things that have happened over the last few centuries.
Our next guest says we're missing part of the picture a lot of the time, and that time and time again throughout American history, an attitude of fun and the desire to cut loose broke through the seriousness, and that attitude helped shape the national character in profound and lasting ways.
Joining us now is John Beckman. He's a professor of English at the U.S. Naval Academy and the author of the new book, American Fun, Four Centuries of Joyous Revolt. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica, Rob.
So this idea that fun is central to American history and identity, When did you start putting that together?
Well, I guess there's kind of a long tail to it. The secret title of the book would probably be the Catholic Boys' History of American Fun, because I went to Catholic school for 12 years. Actually, not too far from where you're at right now. I was in your listening area over in Dubuque, Iowa, and I guess my group of friends were generally kind of rebellious sorts who, you know, pushed back against the nuns and priests and took great risks and pulled stunts whenever we could. And, you know, that's how we enjoyed ourselves in the 70s in Dubuque. And the older I got and, you know, kind of became a scholar of American history, the more I not having really gotten over this kind of fun, went looking for it throughout American history and found it pretty much everywhere. And not just accidentally, but, you know, doing a lot of good work for Americans. So, you know, from the resistance to the Puritans to slaves resisting their masters and, you know, the whole definition of why there was an America during the Revolution was kind of fueled by similar kinds of fun.
And let's talk a little more about the kind of fun, because when I first heard about the book, just from the title, I maybe made the same assumption that a lot of people do. Fun is just something you enjoy. You're talking about a particular kind of fun. Can you hammer that home a little?
Sure. I'm not making it up just out of nowhere. It's, you know, usually appears as a second or third definition in the dictionary of fun. But I think that we tend to assume that fun is amusement or entertainment or something that's kind of leisurely and really lighthearted. But there's this other sense of fun that, you know, we refer to all the time when we use a word, which is this kind of wild, rollicking, you know, risk-taking sort of pleasure that we often do with other people. And, you know, the more the merrier. And it often arises from actually pushing back against norms or laws or what we're expected to do. So that's precisely the kind of fun that I'm following throughout American history, but also kind of making distinctions along the way with all, you know, the lighter sorts of fun that it's sometimes confused with or definitely bound up with.
Yeah, we don't usually see the word fun applied with that much rigor to American history. Why is it important to track that, what you're talking about, through the pages of history?
I think it's important because our you know, firmest identity as Americans and kind of our practice of democracy on the street level, or the way you've had it there over the past couple of years in Madison, even in your capital, arises from struggle. And usually when we think of American struggle, we think of wars and violence and, you know, things as awful as lynchings. And we tend to overlook the more pleasurable kinds of struggle that have actually helped us out as Americans. So this book looks at that history, looks at how, when given the choice, many Americans haven't resorted to violence or, you know, kind of entrenched positions, but have kind of gotten into the fray and mixed it up with people they weren't supposed to mix it up with, or mixed it up in ways that they weren't supposed to.
We'll dig a little deeper into the history, but in your introduction, you set it up with a story that kind of encapsulates what you're talking about of a dance marathon in the 1920s.
Yeah.
Can you tell us that story?
I can try to encapsulate it. You have these eight kids, you know, teens and in their early 20s, who are, it's around 1922, and they're trying to break the world record on dance marathoning in New York City. The world record, I think, was held in Cleveland up to that point. And there was recently this law against holding dance marathons after a certain length of time. And so in order to break the record, they danced out of their dance hall in New York City into a van and drove across the river to New Jersey and kept dancing there until they were kicked out of that dance hall. They got back into the van, dancing all the while, of course, and went to an apartment in Harlem, and then they danced up to Connecticut, and it went on for, you know, a couple of days this way, a few days, and the New York Times were following it, and, you know, all of New York was, you know, treating them as heroes, and eventually this young woman, Vera Shepherd, triumphed, and she broke the world record. I wish I could remember this, 70-some hours or something. And she, when asked how she could stick it out, she said she just kept thinking about what great fun she was having. And I think the fun was the dancing, of course, but it was also just this skylarking effort to, you know, elude all of these laws and do this thing you're not supposed to do in order to prove that you can do it.
So is fun, do you think, the way you describe it, instrumental to making change happen, to pushing forward against, you know, the stuff that holds us in society?
It can be, and it has been, definitely. The Boston Tea Party was this wild party. It was a whole bunch of fun, and I think that part of the reason it was effective, not only in kind of overcoming the Tea Act, because that required dumping all that tea into the harbor, but in really consolidating the American people, you know, around this new image of themselves, was that people had so much fun doing it. And it worked that way in the Wild West for a lot of kind of disenfranchised and rough little communities. It worked that way throughout the 20s. There are plenty of examples of where people are getting together and enjoying themselves and actually overcoming the thing that they're resisting.
It seems like the heroes of your book are the rowdies, people who are being judged probably by a select group of society, or maybe the government or some force. Maybe they're the drunks or people doing dangerous things.
Yeah, right.
Why are they the heroes, and why should we pay more attention to them?
Well, we seldom do, so it's nice to take a look at everybody, right, and see what contributions they're making. But I think they're too easily dismissed as being frivolous often, especially if their contributions are just, you know, as we tend to think, merely fun. And you had mentioned you know, a few minutes ago how this rarely turns up in history books. You often see when these stories do get covered in history books, the historian kind of veering away from the fact that it's fun and, you know, not really wanting to give too much credence to the fun element of it, because that, you know, might diminish the act itself. But, you know, it took a lot of these rough, you know, seeming reprobates or pranksters or jokers often to get the job done.
Well, going back to the American Revolution, when you think of Sam Adams, brewer,
right,
patriot, and I kind of have this image of these dignified men thinking and plotting and doing,
right,
these things. They were drinking and rowdy,
right,
and just, yeah, they were not dignified at all in their initial rebellions, were they?
Well, I wouldn't go that far with Samuel Adams. I do create a, you know, distinction between him and his cousin John Adams, who we, you know, especially revere, because, you know, John Adams was this really sort of tetchy person who really was suspicious of crowd actions, and Samuel Adams really saw the virtue in crowd Adams. In crowd actions, and he would drink along the docks with the dock workers and get to know the people who had become, you know, really effective kind of street level politicians. But he was, you know, a Harvard graduate and, you know, certainly a dignified person of his age, but his interests and I think just in even the mildest way, his behaviors cut across the grain of his class. And a lot of the actions themselves, whether or not he was participating in them, brought a lot of people who otherwise would be considered gentlemen, or their class was that, you know, in leagues with people who were jack tars or who were merchants, or, you know, it brought all of society together.
Well, and to look at another example, the pilgrims, they do not seem like a festive people, but apparently there were some among them who were trying to kind of give a different model about what life in America could be like. Can you talk a little bit about Marymount?
Well, Marymount wasn't exactly among them, and the pilgrims made a point of making sure it wasn't. But so, first of all, there were people who traveled over on the Mayflower who weren't pilgrims, and they really kind of rankled William Bradford and the Separatists because they didn't, you know, toe that line. But the story I tell at the beginning of the book is about this. It's a colony that's set about 30 miles to the north of Plymouth in contemporary Quincy that was founded by this other Englishman who arrived 4 or 5 years after the Mayflower, named Thomas Morton. And he was educated at the English Inns of Court, which is a very satirical sort of society. And he was sympathetic with the more radical English politics of the time. And so, unlike the pilgrims who came to America and they built this spiky fortress to wall out the wilderness and the Native Americans, all of which they suspected, you know, in order to preserve their piety, Thomas Morton just embraced the wilderness, and he embraced Native American culture, and he thought that there was a lot to be found in that. And, long story short, he convinced this group of bond servants to leave their masters, kind of throw off their chains, and form this little colony devoted to drinking and dancing and consorting with Native Americans. And satire was kind of the theme. And they positioned themselves against the pilgrims. And with such kind of force and irritation to the pilgrims that the pilgrims eventually sent a militia to cut down their maypole and send Thomas Morton packing so they could have the culture of the colonies to themselves.
We're talking with John Beckman, author of American Fun, about the role that fun has played, a particular kind of fun, a sort of rowdy, sometimes rebellious fun in American history. We'd like to hear from you, too. Do you see examples of this in American history? Is there a period of time you'd like to ask about? What do you think of the current state of this kind of fun in the United States? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about the role that fun and rebellion have played in American history and culture now with John Beckman. And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234.
We'll go right to our callers now. We've got Dan with us in La Crosse. Dan, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
I live in the western side of Wisconsin, in the Driftless region, where there's these beautiful bluffs from Prairie du Chien up to Red Wing, Minnesota. And me and my friends, what we've come to do is we ride our skateboards down these roads, reaching speeds upwards of 50 miles per hour.
Fantastic. These longboards?
Yes, these are longboards.
Okay.
But technically a skateboard. The catch is that it's illegal in Wisconsin to ride your skateboard on any Wisconsin road. So we risk $150 or $160 ticket every time we do this.
Yeah.
And so while we do it, we get the adrenaline rush of going fast. We get the camaraderie of being within inches of somebody while you're going this fast.
Right.
With, obviously, we have protection, and we've had years of practice, but always in the back of our mind while we're in Wisconsin, not Minnesota, though, is the potential to get the ticket.
Dan, thanks a lot for calling. John, this fits pretty well with a lot of the people you talk about in your book.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's an especially nice match with the Z-Boys from L.A. in the late 70s that I write about a little bit, you know, because they did exactly what the caller is describing in the, you know, the not with longboards, but with, you know, shortboards on the, you know, kind of long hills of Los Angeles. But I think it's a wonderfully eloquent description of fun the author gives there. I actually know those bluffs in that area, and I'm really glad to hear that people are skateboarding on them with protection.
Sounds like you know you're skateboarding too.
Oh, and the less and less. I'm getting a bit old for that kind of thing.
All right. Well, thank you, Dan, for that call. And let's go next to Jacob in Appleton. Hi, Jacob.
County.
Hi, what do you think about fun?
Well, I don't think it's fun, but I mean, I think that a group like hackers are having fun with it. You know, like they're ruining people's computers, or you know, there's just anonymous threats and stuff like that.
Right.
I mean, it's not fun to me, but it just seems like they're a group that would be having fun, or you know, people taking just risks.
Right. Well, thanks a lot, Jacob, for that. It's an interesting example. So they do seem to be, there's elements of theatricality to, you know, groups like Anonymous, right, and definitely Subversion. So they've got a lot of that going on for them. What about that?
Well, I think that's a really important counterexample. There's a great deal of American fun that I ultimately have chosen not to write very much about in this book, which is less civil, you know, that isn't contributing much to the I don't know, the well-being of society, but it's more, you know, kind of criminal activity, which is also, you know, fun. It's just, from the golden age of the pirates on down, there's plenty of criminal fun that's definitely subversive, but it's also kind of taking joy and destruction. So I don't want to cast judgment on it, but I don't write about it. It does make a kind of a confusing sort of doppelganger to a lot, you know, to a lot of the more socially constructive, transgressive fun.
Jacob, thanks for the call. We've got Elizabeth with us next in Milwaukee. Elizabeth, hi.
Yes, apropos of what you just said, mm-hmm. I would mention with horror the lynching of the blacks in the South when, you know, they, I'm sure... If people had, you know, been in sackcloth and ashes and mourning, it wouldn't have lasted, but it lasted because it was made into a big celebration.
Right.
I mean, horrifying, but I think that's what helped perpetuate the horrible custom for so long.
Elizabeth, thanks for the call. And race is a big and complicated issue that you talk right. about in your book. Mm-hmm. Can you touch on that just a little bit?
Well, certainly, it's hard to touch on it a little bit. First, I would like to agree, you know, heartily with the previous caller that as part of the staying power of lynching was that there was this kind of communal carnival surrounding it. It became, you know, this grisly and cruel form of entertainment. You know, they would serve concessions, and the whole family would come out for these. And pleasure gives, for better or for worse, you know, all sorts of activity, staying power within a community. But on the flip side, much of the racial kind of racially defined activity that I write about in this book is from groups who are, you know, out groups for their race, and they pull themselves together through often, you know, transgressive behavior, whether it's dancing or, you know, pulling pranks or something. But that is kind of in support of their race as opposed to opposed to it.
Okay, well, thank you for that call. And next we go to Joe in Prairie du Chien. Hey, Joe.
Hi. I'd be curious, are people like Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert using this approach to override the standard message that we hear and use fun and humor as a way to bypass the man, as it were, and give us a better, a more open approach to life?
I think the two people whom you just named are, you know, our two highest profile pranksters in America. They do set a high example, and I think that a lot of people do participate in a political sort of fun, you know, thanks to that. They've actually invited people out of their homes and then onto the Washington Mall over the past couple of years. So, you know, it's not only about watching television for them, which I think is pretty impressive as well.
On that note, John, how would you assess the current state of fun here in the United States?
Oh, well, I can, you know, wring my hands over it and would, you know, for the fact that we're all, you know, staring at our smartphones and screens and, you know, that we've become such a spectatorial society, and I think that makes us much more passive. But every day you see wonderful examples to the contrary. This past weekend out in L.A., that those wonderful parodic artists opened up that dumb Starbucks, as it was called, where it was this some of the listeners may know this because it got pretty good coverage in a strip mall in L.A. They opened a perfect mock-up of a Starbucks, except it was called a dumb Starbucks. And people queued up around the block to participate in this prank. And I think it exposed quite a lot about, you know, the banality of corporate culture, and people enjoyed, you know, taking part in that joke. So there's creative fun happening all over the place, but we do kind of have to open our eyes to it and let ourselves participate in it.
Well, John, thank you so much for coming on today and talking fun.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me on Central Time.
That was John Beckman, author of the new book, American Fun, Four Centuries of Joyous Revolt. We've been talking about the role that fun has played in American history and the development of our culture.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll take a look at what Congress is up to this week, including House and Senate votes on the debt ceiling.
First, the Archdiocese of Milwaukee says it's filing its bankruptcy reorganization plan. It released it earlier today. According to church officials, the plan includes $4 million for child sexual abuse victims.
The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that if approved, it would be by far the smallest sexual abuse settlement by any Catholic Church bankruptcy of this size filed to date.
Joining us now is Chuck Kornbach, WPR's reporter in Milwaukee, who's covering the story today. Chuck, welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon.
So, Chuck, briefly, how did we get to this situation today with this bankruptcy reorganization plan?
Well, of course, the Archdiocese declared bankruptcy about 3 years ago, just over 3 years ago, and there's been a long court fight in federal court, bankruptcy court, over the details, how many people would be included, what the creditors would get, whether people should be excluded, and so on. And we've finally come today where the Archdiocese has proposed a reorganization plan.
We mentioned the $4 million of settlement money in the intro. Who would get that money? What would it go for?
Well, part of the money would go towards the helping the victims deal with their lives and make adjustments and so on. There would also be some money separate from that to go to a therapy fund, and there would also be an attempt to help the victims sue the church's insurance companies to get more money from the insurance companies. The church is insured, obviously, on these things like this, and there's been a battle back and forth between the church and its insurance companies at times. The Archdiocese is promising to help folks make headway against the insurance companies.
I think a lot of people were watching for what that number was going to be, but what are other key parts of the bankruptcy reorganization plan?
Well, that seems to be the main focus of it. I mean, all of the other archdioceses that have settled around the country, and there's been 6, 7, or 8 or so, there have been much higher amounts. The dollar amount for the victims seems to be the main focus. Now, this one also includes an invitation for the victims to come, chat with the Archbishop, Jerome Listecki, and discuss things. And as I say, this long-term therapy promise. But, it's controversial.
Now, the group SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, held a press conference this afternoon. You were there. What was their response, especially to that amount of money?
Quite critical. The press conference was still going on a few moments ago. The terms that were used by some of the speakers include tragic. One person that had been sexually abused as a child suggested this was like being abused again. This time the Archdiocese, and with the dollar amount it offered, so quite critical. I think the victims groups will try to encourage bankruptcy judge Susan Kelly, who will be getting this reorganization plan, to not accept it. That there should be more in the way of financial compensation and other things. As I say, the strong remarks from the SNAP group this afternoon.
And for the Archbishop's part, how did he present the plan and that amount of money with the knowledge probably that this was not a large amount of money compared to other settlements around the country?
Well, he's told WPR and others that no amount is going to make everyone happy. So he's sort of saying this is what they have. He's also suggesting they would have to go into debt to come forward with this money. The critics of the Archdiocese point out there's been a long battle over a multi-million dollar cemetery trust fund that the victims want. opened up to potentially, you know, to be divided among some of the victims. There's also the issue of whether parish money is separate from the archdiocese. The archdiocese, I think, has argued that the parishes are separate. And so there's a bigger pool out there that the victims would like, to which victims would like access.
You mentioned the judge in this case. What is next? What's the timeline for a decision on whether this plan can go ahead?
Well, we don't quite know the timetable. As I say, we're 3 years in. I don't think it's going to be that long before it's resolved, but it might be a few weeks. I think there are other creditors that would like, from the archdiocese, that would like to know what it means for them. Finally today, the victims were saying, they didn't get, the first they learned of this was on a commercial conservative talk radio program this morning, that the archdiocese never met with them to say, well, this is what we're going to announce tomorrow, what do you think, anything like that. It was a total surprise to the victims, and that has rubbed salt in the wounds as well.
So the Archbishop called this a major step toward ending the bankruptcy, returning the church's focus to the primary mission of the church. But I know we can't predict the future, but it seems like it's going to be a while before things are back to normal for the Archdiocese.
Well, and the victims suggest that the longer the church takes on this matter, that the church is losing registered members, at least in the Milwaukee area. The victims say this has a long-term damage, sort of self-inflicted wound that the church is doing, and that the longer things drag out, that the more harm that will be done to the church. Now, of course, in any negotiations, there's often back and forth, so we'll see if Judge Kelly does not accept this agreement. The victims are saying we might go to federal appeals court, probably be down in Chicago, and there might be judges in other states that would be see things differently. So, yes, this could go on a while if the victims don't get an amount closer to what they want. And they declined today at the news conference to say exactly what dollar figure would make them whole. They just pointed out how small this was, this $4 million offer was in comparison to other bankruptcies around the country.
Chuck, thanks a lot for covering this and joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Chuck Kornbach, our WPR reporter in Milwaukee.
It's time now to turn our focus to Washington for our weekly spotlight on Congress. Yesterday, the House voted to increase the debt limit with a clean, no-strings-attached bill, and the Senate approved that plan earlier today. After frequent debate during the past couple of years, it will now be a year before Congress debates that limit again.
Also, with a dangerous ice storm hitting the South today, the Senate held a panel on extreme weather preparedness to talk about the role that the federal government can play in dealing with situations like that Atlanta shutdown a couple of weeks back. USA Today's Congress and politics editor Paul Singer joins us every Wednesday at this time to share his thoughts on what's going on in Congress. He tweets from @SingerNews. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Great. Thanks for having me again.
A lot of drama on the debt ceiling this week. It wasn't quite a sure thing in the House yesterday, was it?
No. We were watching the numbers as the people are voting. We're like, okay, they need about 10 more. They need about 12 more. But they did get over the hump, and the House did pass it. What's interesting is that it passed almost entirely on Democratic votes. There was only, I think, 28 or 29 Republican votes for this debt ceiling increase, including the Speaker of the House, John Boehner.
What does this mean for Speaker Boehner? I mean, he could have put the kibosh on this whole thing, right, and not allowed a vote at all.
Yeah, he could have. But then, of course, he'd be wearing that debt default around his neck if America went into some sort of economic disaster. In fact, I think, even as we speak, they have just posted my analysis of this whole thing, that John Boehner ends up being the big winner here because he gets the debt ceiling issue off the plate for the rest of the year.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government funding has already been resolved for the rest of the year. And so between now and the 2014 elections, basically Boehner is not in jeopardy of having the House completely mess up the government and therefore completely mess up Republican election hopes in 2014.
Okay, but isn't he wearing the clean debt ceiling increase that members of his own party didn't want around his neck for letting that happen?
Yes, he is. However, the good news for him on that front is that then he can say, well, yeah, but this is all paying for old bills, and it's because the Democrats refused to cut spending, and we couldn't get it through the Senate anyway, and there's no point barking up a tree if we don't have the votes to pass it. So this just proves why we need more Republicans in Congress.
And I'd seen headlines and emails from conservative groups using the word surrender, referring to House Republicans.
And that's the thing, is that amongst the Tea Party, they see this as a surrender or a traitorous sellout. You know, they basically said, they said 6 months ago, and then and Boehner had said a year ago, we're going to make some demands on a debt ceiling. We're not going to raise a debt ceiling until we get some offsetting cuts. And they didn't get them. And that is a significant compromise. But again, for Boehner's position, he may be best off losing on this issue, as it were, getting this issue done and over with for the rest of the year, and then letting the Tea Party groups and other Republicans go to the floor of the House the rest of the year and complain and call for, you know, deeper cuts, because that's the message they want the party to run on in November.
Do you reckon that any of the Republicans who voted for that increase could face a primary challenge still this year?
Well, oddly enough, one of the Republicans that voted for it, a guy named Gary Miller from California, announced today that he's retiring at the end of the year. Mm. So solve that.
He was
problem.
Safe.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, today in the Senate, there was a really interesting chapter of this where it was not clear the Senate was going to pass this thing either. And then Senator Mitch McConnell stepped forward, the Republican leader, and voted for it. And that is where you get an interesting primary challenge, because he's already got a Tea Party group attacking him for being too moderate. He's got a Tea Party challenger in his Republican primary for re-election in Kentucky. And that was a tough swallow for Mitch McConnell to go to the floor and basically provide the momentum to get the debt ceiling bill to the floor.
Well, let's talk about some of the drama on the Senate floor. As I understand it, this is just a little while ago today. There was an attempt at a filibuster. Is that right?
Well,
or a delay?
Yeah, I'm not sure how to phrase it. You know, the Senate has gone so past normal procedure. I mean, the way this works is there's two votes in the Senate. There's one to bring the bill to the floor, and then the second to pass the bill. And that one, to bring the bill to the floor, requires 60 votes. And there was a question whether anybody was going to stand up and object, and nobody did, but they couldn't get the 60 votes. So for about an hour, we were sitting here watching the TV and watching the senators all standing on the floor, sort of jawboning each other and arm twisting going on to try and get the 60 votes they needed on that vote. And it sort of hung in the balance. Again, they needed one or two more Republican votes. And that's when McConnell particularly sort of led a small group of Republicans to come down and actually vote for the thing. That then puts it over the hurdle. Now we can bring the bill to the floor. And then, of course, when it comes time to pass the bill, that's only a 50-vote majority necessary. And all the Republicans go back to voting against it.
There was talk that someone like, say, Ted Cruz might actively filibuster, but it sounds more like a passive resistance. We're not blocking it, but we're not blocking it at the same time.
Yeah, and you know it's going to snow, right?
Right. I mean, well, there is that.
So, yeah, no, I mean, that's not really kidding. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the senators, like everybody else, want to get out of here and go home. And they had an agreement that we'll just go down, we'll have this vote, and then, presuming it passes, we will just move on and vote on the bill. Because nobody wants to spend, you know, the next 5 days buried in a snowstorm in Washington, D.C. We want to go home.
So looking ahead on this thing, now it's going to pass. The debt ceiling is going to go up.
Yep.
Were we right? It's about a year before we'll have to talk about this again?
Yeah. It'll be a year before we have to talk about the debt ceiling. That's March 2015. You know, federal spending is still an issue because that deal expires in September. But it's hard to imagine, really, a major battle over keeping the government open 3 weeks or was it 6 weeks before an election. So you have to assume that one will be fairly easy to kick past the November elections. So we'll be doing neither debt nor spending for the rest of the year.
But this is a thing we keep coming back to again and again. It's put off for a year now. Is there any talk of doing this differently so we don't have to have these near or complete train wrecks every so often?
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk about that in the past couple of months. Even, in fact, I believe it was a couple of years ago, the Senate had some language in a bill that passed that allowed the government to raise the debt ceiling by itself for a brief period of time. One of the ideas is to reverse the burden here so that the administration, the White House, would be able to raise the debt ceiling on its own with giving Congress the right to veto that with a vote against it. That would still give Congress the power to say no, but it wouldn't require them to make the painful vote to say yes. But, you know, it's just really hard to do stuff like that, to pass legislation like that, because, again, the Republicans will say, well, we don't trust the Obama administration, and then once there's a Republican president, the Democrats will say, well, we don't trust the Republican administration. It's just hard to get that kind of change in place. But it's possible, because I think there's enough frustration and concern. And even now among Republicans, they didn't really like the way this whole thing played out. They ended up getting nothing.
So they're done with the debt ceiling. Now what do they have to do for the rest of the year?
Oh, well, there's plenty of vacations to take. not much. I mean, a strong case could be made that the competitive portion of this legislative season is over. They want to do immigration. There's been a lot of talk about immigration, but Republicans have already started suggesting that they're not going to do it this year because, again, they don't trust Obama to enforce the law. There's maybe some NSA reforms that they're going to try to do. There's, you know, a handful of other bills that will probably come along a pass, but I honestly think that there's nothing else that is must pass until we get to September and we got to keep the government open. So that's one of the reasons I declare Boehner a winner in my little column this afternoon, because now they can just turn the floor over to making political points, not necessarily legislating.
And nobody's going to do anything really big and dramatic, do you think, in an election year?
Well,
never know, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the part of the issue is no one's going to do anything bipartisan. And if you want to do anything big and dramatic, it usually helps to have other people on your side. And I don't expect that to happen at this point. Now, again, I don't discount the possibility of bolt of lightning on any topic, right? I mean, if there is, you know, God forbid we need $50 billion worth of bailout money for Georgia after today's storms, you know, something like that. Well, that's when Congress usually comes together in a bipartisan fashion, moves some sort of a bill. But I'm not – at this moment, we are really scratching our heads. They finish these bills. They're off next week. It's 2 weeks before they're back in session at all, and they don't want to do immigration particularly at this moment. So we're not really sure what they take up next.
Well, you mentioned that weather that you've got coming, the storm, the ice storm expected in Atlanta, and the Senate today is holding a panel on extreme weather preparedness and what the federal government can do about it. What led to this happening?
You know, part of what led to it, I believe, was the headlines out of Georgia last week. Mm-hmm. But it's also something they've been working on for a while. They had a GAO has done some studies on this. This gets back to goes back to Katrina, really, and this discussion has been going on, that we don't plan well for disasters, and we allow people to build in stupid places, and we are careless about protecting our infrastructure, and we don't really notice it until it gets knocked over by a windstorm, and then the whole country floods in billions of dollars to rebuild it all until it gets knocked over in the next storm. And I think this is part of what this committee was trying to get at, is there a way to do this better? And their numbers, and I'm just calling the story back up here, they said it was $1.5 trillion in economic losses between 1980 and 2010 due to poor preparation for emergency weather. And they think it's another $1 trillion in the next 10 or 15 years if we don't do better by, like, you know, strengthening our housing codes, or redoing our flood maps, or being more cautious about where we build and how we build in weather or disaster areas.
Is this just a mental exercise on the Senate committee's part or panel's part, or do you think something might actually come from this?
It is, I think, mostly a mental exercise. I mean, they have been revising flood insurance, the National Flood Insurance Program, over the past few years to make the flood insurance costs reflect the real risks of where you live. That's probably a benefit. Although even that, it ended up hitting so hard on particularly Florida and a couple other places, that all of a sudden their flood insurance rates are going through the roof, that Congress is now backpedaling and trying to sort of ease in those cost increases. There are things that the federal government is trying to do, the Senate and Congress are trying to do, to rebalance the way we reward risky behavior. But it's hard to do. Everybody's got an interest in, I don't want people building on the Outer Banks, North Carolina, until I buy my beach house there, and then I want everyone to build out there, and I want to be insured for being out there. Just kind of the way it works.
And I have, just briefly, have words like climate change or global warming been thrown around?
Yeah. Yeah, the part of the hearing today was about how climate change makes that worse. If we're going into this period, as the meteorologists tell us we are, of more extreme weather, then the need to batten down the hatches becomes more serious. Again, if we're not prepared, it doesn't matter if it's not raining. But when it starts raining, and raining a lot, and raining a lot more, then we're going to be in trouble. And their argument is it costs a lot less to prepare than it does to repair.
Paul, good luck with your weather out there, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, Rob. Take care.
That's Paul Singer, politics and Congress editor at USA Today. He joins us this time every week.